Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
Welcome to Publishing Rodeo. We have with us this week Alexandra Darwin, who's, I guess, would you say hybrid author? You started out indie, you kind of moved to trad, and that's a whole journey in itself. And I first encountered his books as someone who's writing, the way it's marketed, like science fantasy. And that was really interesting to me because at the time I'd started jiu-jitsu, which I don't know, we'll almost certainly end up talking about that sport later in this episode. But if you want to introduce yourself, Alex, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Anya. Good to see you, you and Scott. And yeah, I think hybrid is an apt term. I like hybrid. Why not? Like, why pick a camp? Have the flexibility to go either way if you want to. But you did a great job describing Combat Codes is my first debut series, which was originally self-published and subsequently picked up by Orbit Books. And at this point, the first two books in the series are released, Combat Codes and Grivar's Blood. And the third book is due out in December of 2024. And the basic premise is a world where wars have been replaced with single unarmed combat duels between champions, and the outcome of these duels determine the fate of nations. So essentially a new political system, which I often wish we had in real life, whether it's feasible or not.
Does the US have any UFC champions right now? Would we end up on top of that?
I think we do all right. Yeah, we got. I mean, yeah. John Jones is like just got arrested, I think, so he's probably not in the mix
again.
But, you know, yeah.
Do I remember right that you told me you actually kind of got film interest first? You came at Trad Publishing like totally circumnavigating backwards, sideways.
Yeah, I mean, the more I listen to like podcasts like yours, it seems like the route of authors, whether it be finding an agent or an editor in trad, is not as straightforward as it appears. Or maybe it's just outliers that are coming onto podcasts and telling their stories. But yeah, the Combat Codes did well in Mark Lawrence's SPFBO or SPIFBO, depending on how you like to pronounce that contest.
Can I ask real quick? I'm so sorry to interrupt, but because you're going back to that stage in your story, can I ask how you came to enter in that? Did you query and try for trad first and then decide to do that? Or did you just go straight for SFPBO or whatever the hell the acronym is?
Yeah. So I feel like I'm not only like a discovery writer, but like a discovery person in life, where I kind of just, I don't know if it's just wandering upon stuff, but I was in San Francisco, living in San Francisco, and had a startup, essentially a failed startup. And so it was kind of on the way out, and we were trying to figure out what to do with our lives. And I was like, I've always, you know, been a fantasy sci-fi reader. So I wrote the first iteration of the Combat Codes, and I didn't even know what trad publishing was. I didn't even know anything, the fact that you could get an agent. I had zero knowledge, but I did know that there was something called Amazon KDP, and because I had been in that world of tech. And I thought, you know, this must be the way that you put a book out there, because, you know, in the world of startups, it makes sense that something like this would work. And so I just learned that world, and again, didn't even understand that there was another option at that point, which obviously now is very naive. Kind of on a whim, you know, the book had done all right, but I had primarily pushed it towards like jiu-jitsu folks, which I'm sure Sunyi and you know is a very small niche. I mean, it's growing, but people that actually practice like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So I pushed it towards them, and you know, it did well in that niche.
I don't see that being a big reading group.
exactly. And the audiobook clearly must sell better. But I saw on a whim, I was, you know, on Reddit or something, and saw that there was this SPFBO contest. I think it was in the third or fourth year, where Mark Lawrence every year runs it for self-published fantasy sci-fi author or fantasy authors. And then they have judges come in. There's 300 original entrants, and then they whittle it down to like semifinalists, and then a final 10 that kind of duke it out. And there's a winner every year. Again, I wasn't planning on entering. I just saw it somewhere and threw it in the mix.
You know, you're talking about it being a little bit of a small readership group. And I remember when my instructor found out that I write books, he proudly told me he'd never read more than one book in his whole adult life, and he's 48. Uh-huh. So I think there are probably about two people in my whole school who read regularly.
So yes. Well, just, you need to get the audiobook to them, Sunyi. I bet they listen to podcasts. So that might be a better bet.
I did find out later that he listens to audiobooks. He just didn't really think of it as reading. And I was like, no, I get royalties for audiobooks. It's reading.
Hey, I did see, though, Alex, that you got Ryan Hall and, God, who else was it that blurbed your book?
Kenny Florian.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's awesome. That's legit. I remember watching Ryan's season of The Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah, no, I've met him a few times. He's a very interesting, good guy. He's very analytical, super technical, as you can imagine. Like,
yeah,
kind of a great representative of jiu-jitsu. Like, as he would look like a nerd on the street, and then he's like some. I guess that's his nickname, the Wizard, which also is apt for SFF fans.
Yeah, yes, it is.
The other question I was going to quickly ask you, and the sense from SFPO, like, it was created to celebrate self-published novels, but increasingly it feels like a pipeline to convert self-pub to trad. And I just wondered if you had thoughts on that particularly or not really.
I think there has been a uptick. I know, like, there's definitely been a handful, and for sure I know, like, editors at the big SFF imprints, Orbit and Tor and a few others, like, kind of hang out, or used to at some point hang out on and follow the winners and read some of that. I think one of the first ones to get picked up was Grey Bastards, about the orcs that ride war hogs. I think that one got picked up by Valentine or Macmillan, I want to say. And then one of the big ones was Josiah Bancroft, Senlin, that got picked up. And that was not even that. So my book made it into the finals. I did not win. But I think Senlin, excuse me, was not even in the, it was like semifinals, and Mark Lawrence really liked it and kind of pushed it. And it eventually got picked up by Orbit.
Last Gifts of the Universe. I think I just finished blurbing that one because I actually read it when Rory self-published it, and they put it through SIFBO and ended up getting editor interest and then picking up an agent. And now it's coming out trad. So,
well, it makes a lot of sense because, like, in essence, the judges, like, they have so many rounds of judges and bloggers, and it's also getting a bunch of hype to start off that editors would be sifting through that material, because there's a lot of, you know, pre-marketing research being done there, essentially, that then doesn't need to be done.
Yeah, it's basically a bunch of focus groups that trad wishes they could do anyway, so it makes a lot of sense.
Right. I think I've heard of stories, though, where, you know, some of these self-pub books that are really taking off. I mean, Combat Codes got to a point after SPIFBO where it got a bump from SPIFBO, and it was selling, but by no means did I expect it. It already had, like, the first trajectory with the very small jiu-jitsu audience, and then it got the SFF audience. But still, if I didn't, you know, put my own resources into it at that point, it would have eventually fizzled. And in that industry, you have to keep really producing at a high rate to be successful. And so I saw it as a great opportunity when Orbit made the offer. I do know for a fact that, like, a lot of self-published authors over the years have turned down trad if they're in that, like, upper echelon of they're supporting. I mean, like, what do we all want? What do I still want is to be able to support myself writing. I mean, I haven't gotten to that point yet, and that's still on my bucket list, you know, with three kids and a mortgage, that's a tall order. As you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I don't have any illusions of, you know, that would require quite a bit, and I'm fine doing what I'm doing because it takes some of the pressure off of writing. But, you know, if you, whether you're self-pub or trad and you're paying your bills and that's your main income, that's a kind of a bucket list / dream to be able to do.
So when you got into trad, you know, I guess it's a very general question, but how did you find the experience? Because the thing that we are building up to is I know that you did a lot of work yourself with, I guess, your marketing background and your self-pub background to try and boost that debut and to try lots of different things. And hopefully you've had, I guess, time to see what's worked and what hasn't and what you would maybe do again.
Well, and how quickly did you go from SFPBO, or I probably keep butchering that, but how quickly did you go from that contest to the Orbit deal? Like
it was 1 or 2 years at least. It all is a blur because it was 2020. Okay. It was COVID when Spiffbo during that year. It kind of takes a year for the contest to cycle through, a little bit less, where because they have multiple rounds of judging. And then it was like a whole nother year until Orbit made an official offer. And then, as you know, how long traditional publishing takes, how slow things go, then it wasn't another 2 years until, you know, here we are. The Combat Codes wasn't published until June of 2023, so less than a year ago. And Sunny, to answer, so that's obviously a good question. I have come equipped. I hope that, you know, debut authors listening that are either going from self-pub to trad, because I know that's a lot more common now than it used to be, or just starting in trad, can take some wisdom from my experimentation, you know. And there's definitely pluses and minuses in me having, I think, going into trad, having a self-pub mindset, which I, you know, I've always thought like that, you know, being, you know, whether it be, you know, startups or, you know, putting my own book out there, I've always, you know, not really tried to rely too much on other people. So I really did, you know, what I could. And I think there are some things that were successful and some that were not successful on my part. And so hopefully I can help out people and give some guidance moving forward. So, yeah. I mean, I could jump into that. I don't want to just list stuff off. So, if, you know, whatever you guys think.
You know, you signed with Orbit. What did Orbit say they were going to do for you? Or rather, let's focus on what did Orbit do for you? And then were there areas where you're looking at it thinking, oh, this is something I can take over and do myself faster, better, you know, more specifically?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I was not so strategic in my carrying out of various marketing efforts. I kind of like came upon them as I saw them and went after them. And as far as what, you know, I got a pretty good advance. And so I do feel like Orbit put some good marketing effort behind the book. I've listened to a lot as far as like the importance of ARCs, physical ARCs, and they really did put out a lot of ARCs. Mm-hmm. Now that's actually my first point on the physical ARCs end. Is, you know, I think for what would be considered mid-list books, as far as Orbit goes, it seems like they do put out physical ARCs. Yeah. But I always felt that even in the, like, you know, mixed martial arts fans, like the, you know, UFC fans, even though we know, like, the readership is not that high, I still felt like there was a big segment of that population that I didn't have the ability to reach out to. And so I basically what I did is, you know, created a pretty in-depth spreadsheet of, and I did a bunch of research. And I don't forget, I also through self-pub, it's not like I was starting from scratch. I had already a lot of connections within like the blogger world. And so there was people, whether it be booktubers or, you know, book talkers or influencers that I right off the bat knew that I wanted to get an ARC to. And so, again, this is not like me just randomly listing people. I kind of had to put in the legwork to assist Orbit and the PR team to get books out to the people that I thought would be most influential. And that is really, I mean, if I had to highlight one thing that's going to be the most, if your publisher does is sending out physical arcs. I would say that was probably the most important slash what moved books the best of anything I did, just being able to have, you know, some control. Because I think basically, especially as far as midlist goes, I mean, a big five publisher will typically, you know, they have their contacts. They have bloggers that they work with and they're regularly sending advanced copies to. And I think they will put in effort to figure out which bloggers might vibe with your book better. But based on just the amount of time that, you know, these great people have, I have a great relationship with the PR person, Angela at Orbi, who did like a fantastic job. And again, but end of the day, we all know everyone in publishing is spread so thin and they only have so much bandwidth that they can, you know, they can use for every author. And so I think it actually was a big, whether or not I created more work for people, I don't know, probably, maybe, but I think it really, from my point of view, was helpful because I saw end of the day that a lot of the people that I ended up listing, and they had no problem sending arcs out to that fairly extensive list that I created. So I get, again, I think I did that legwork because it's not like I was just like, I went onto TikTok. I was trying to, I'm done with TikTok at this point, but like up until my launch, I like was able to build like maybe 10,000 followers, which was not too bad. And so I was on there a lot for that lead up, and I was doing research on like which book talk influencers would most like the combat codes. And so I was collecting information. I was going to websites, I was doing all the legwork in the spreadsheet, like finding addresses. Because to mail something, you have to think about the logistics of mailing. Like if you're mailing outside of the US, you need phone numbers associated with it. You need the names and obviously mailing addresses. And so again, I pretty much put together this big spreadsheet of the people both within the SFF sphere as well as like the martial arts world, as well as whatever else I thought might be useful. And I did end up, you know, post facto end up seeing a lot of these people that got it and then reviewed it. And I think especially now, those circles, those spheres like BookTube and BookTok, we could talk about Twitter. I don't think Twitter really moves the needle much, as I think you guys probably would agree. But like those are BookTube and BookTok. So like YouTube, the book community on there, and then BookTok, those are like really fairly influential in my opinion. Like some of those people have like, I don't want to say millions, but like maybe millions of followers, BookTube, like hundreds of thousands of viewers, and they really take their recommendations quite seriously, and they kind of use them given how much content there is now, and it's like how hard it is to, you know, find your next read. And I think they use these people as kind of like guides for what they're going to read. So if they like a book, or if they even if they don't like it, to be honest, and they just put it out there and say what it's about, that's going to move some books. So of anything, like I've kind of like looked back at the year and all the things I've done, and we can talk about some of the other things that I thought worked and didn't work. I think that's like, if your publisher is actually sending out physical arcs, that I think is a really big deal if you can help them out, assist them. And I know not everyone has the bandwidth to, you know, put that effort in. But again, I was kind of starting from a good place. You know, I have a marketing business, and then also, so I had the flexibility to be able to allocate that time and the resources. And then also coming from self-pub, this is what you do. In self-pub, you have to scrap. This is everything you do. So it's like, this was just what I would do anyways. I didn't really know any other way to do it. I think that did create like a little bit of stress for me personally, looking back on it, like not having the control that, you know, going from self-pub again, you have like, that's the real dilemma. Should I do self-pub? Should I do trad? If you have a choice, like if you want to do self-pub, do you want to run your own business? Do you want to put on all the resources to do that? Do you want to like have no support really outside of yourself? Then maybe you can do that. And then obviously the benefit of trad is having perhaps a wider reach as well as a team to work behind you. And you ideally long-term being able to just write, which still is kind of my ultimate goal, which would be nice. I like some of the marketing stuff, but it's also a little bit stressful for me. And so that initial scrap mentality of self-pub, I think did clash a little bit at the start. okay, now there's a whole team working with me, and there's limitations and resources. There's only a finite amount of resources available. So all of that kind of played into it.
Yeah, I was nodding along as you're saying that, because I think, like, even if you were trying to focus this year on things that people can do to help themselves, because having spent all of last year saying very little you do matters, I think actually it is more nuanced than that. And that sometimes you don't always know what works, nothing is guarantees, but you often don't know till you try. And I'm not as organized as you were, but I did definitely, I think in the run up to my debut, you know, I'd go on social media, I'd see someone saying like, oh, I really want this Ark of the Book Readers, but I can't get it. I wasn't approved for NetGalley. I didn't win the giveaway. And I would reach out to them and send it, because I had ARCs from my publisher, or I had early author copies that I could send. And for me, that was a good use of my time and money. And I wasn't even like necessarily doing research. It was just like, I still probably shifted over 100 copies doing that, I think, close to. Mm-hmm. I mean, TikTok, I'm interested to hear why you left it, if you feel like talking into it, because I think I was on yeah. TikTok for a bit. Until I found this influencer who had about twice as many followers as I have sales to date, aided my book, and I was just like, oh, I'm going to call off here and never come back. So,
I totally understand that. Yeah, TikTok, I was like, okay, this is a big thing. I'm going to up to my book launching, I'm going to try to do what I can. And so I went after it, and I like built the following. Like at first, I think it was mainly like martial arts, because I was posting videos of like, fights and like doing commentary, just like whatever. And then eventually I like kind of was transitioning more towards books. I was just trying to figure out like catchy things. Like I was taking two books together and like smushing them together to become one book, with like editing. And that was kind of a hit. Like one of those videos got like 200,000 views and exposed combat codes. So I think, I mean, I don't know how the tough thing with all of this that kind of is frustrating, especially coming from a marketing background, is like being on the author side, you really have zero data as far as what's working, and you can't really track your efforts very well. So you have to shoot in the dark to some extent, but you have a gut feeling of what's working and what's not, to some extent as well. TikTok was just, you know, being on it, it just wasn't. Like I've largely moved off Twitter at this point. Not really as I mean, it's just the brain drain of all these things I was seeing affecting my mental health and preventing me from actually like writing, which is, you know, I tend to get super obsessive about things. And so I would just be like, I'm marketing. And then I wouldn't be actually writing, which is what I want to be doing. Again, like end of the day, marketing is what I do for a living right now, but I would rather be writing. That's you know why I'm here in the first place.
If I stay on Twitter, it's a matter of time before I end up in jail for murder, and then like that's basically why I needed to just step back.
I was just going to comment that I think that union of author effort and publisher effort is really good to see, right? And you handing a list of targeted reviewers, influencers, whatever, and your publisher actually going after that is pretty amazing. Like I haven't heard of that happening for a lot of people, which is awesome. Well, it's not awesome that does it, but it's awesome that they did that for you. And my question on the back of that is, I'm just curious, you know, Sunny said she sent out maybe 100 ARCs on her own. I know her publishers sent out a bunch. So I didn't get ARCs at all, but I sent out finished copies to probably ballpark 100 people. I'm curious if you know how many ARCs Orbit sent out at your request versus not at your request, and, you know, total, what that effort looked like.
So I'm not aware of the total amount. I guess I never asked them the total amount. I do know that outside of the list I provided there, because I've seen the book end up in a bunch of other hands outside of the book. I think my list was like maybe 50, 60 people. You know, like it was a pretty decent sized list. And then again, I don't know specifically how many they sent out outside of this. And I'm just talking about the US. The book was bought by both the Orbit US as well as UK. And I had a lot more interface with the US team. I think that's half the battle in the beginning, especially. This is something I had to kind of adapt to. So I'm not saying this was like a smooth process, and I was just like, the book was acquired and I wasn't stressed at all, because I was certainly stressed. And you're looking at like what other authors are getting, and you're feeling like is this fair? Is this not fair? But like, eventually I feel like I hit my stride. A big part of it for me is the relationships. My relationship with my editor has always been really good. You know, very beginning, the only part that was, you know, stressful was it was acquired by an editor and then she left publishing essentially during that big exodus. Was it in 2022 when like a ton of editors were leaving? And so then I got a new editor, which is always a little bit scary because, you know, this isn't the person that acquired it, but it ended up working out really well. And so those relationships with my editor and actually with my PR contact at Orbit ended up being really integral because I know different editors work in different ways. Like in some cases, an author might only be in contact with their editor and the editor will serve as kind of the liaison to everyone else. And I think that still was the relationship and is the relationship. But just knowing that there was someone on the other end on the PR and the PR side of things, because again, I work with PR people in my day job, and I know how even in other industries, how spread thin they are on everything. And like they're getting requests from like 1,000 different angles. And so I think it's really important, as passionate as you are about your book, and as much as this is your baby that you've been working so hard on, to at least, you know, acknowledge in your interactions with these people that you need to, you know, be not only polite, but, you know, realistic about what is possible and not possible. At the same time, I think it's important not to be afraid to ask. And I think I asked for a lot of things that I got to know, and just being like, okay, it is what it is. I'm going to keep, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask for things. To go back to like TikTok, any platform, I think if you have the ability to create some sort of angle for your PR team to use, because like from a PR perspective, they're pushing out a lot of books, and the books naturally have their own angles, right? They're targeted towards certain audience. You have like romanticy, or you have a book that's action heavy, like Combat Codes. And so they're going to be using those already. But if you can give them another specific angle to easily reach out to XYZ magazine, XYZ, you know, blogger, and say, hey, I've got this for you. Mm-hmm. You know, do you want to run with it? And so what I did is I put together, or I outsourced essentially like a video, like the Combat Codes. One of my big inspirations is like old school RPGs, like Final Fantasy. And so the world of the Combat Codes is like science fantasy, much like some of those games where it's like a cross between, you know, technology and magic. And so I thought it would be cool to put together like a video, an animation of the actual Combat Codes characters / story in like video, old school 2D pixelated Final Fantasy-esque graphics. And so I put that together, you know, kind of took a risk, because, you know, I was putting resources into this and, you know, I didn't know how Orbit would react, whether they'd be like, okay, that's stupid, don't just like do that on your own, or whether they would be like, all right, that's actually pretty cool. And so it turned out like I put it together. I outsourced it, and I sent the animation to my editor, and he passed it around the team, and they were like, actually, we have like a ton of Final Fantasy fans on the team, and they thought it was really cool. And then they were able to do what I would not be able to do, because I'm not in the PR part of this industry or any industry. And so they pushed it out to a bunch of resources. It ended up getting coverage from like Gizmodo, and like had a whole piece from Gizmodo. And so like that wouldn't have been something that without that content I provided, they wouldn't have been able to do that. They wouldn't have been able to say, here's another book, do you want to cover this? And so I think, again, providing something that they can use, if you have, I totally understand, based on bandwidth, based on resources, not everyone might be able to do that. But, you know, I wanted to take that angle.
Yeah.
I do think there's merit as well in telling people that, like, it's not that everyone has to go out and copy and do everything you did in the way you did it, that everyone can find their own place and, like, I can't have millions of followers on TikTok. I can't be a star YouTuber like some authors that are really, really good at it. I definitely wouldn't know where to start putting together a video, but I did a podcast, so that works for me.
Yeah.
Do you ever play Blaze Blue? Is that a really weird question?
I have not. What system was it on?
It's a newer fighting game. Oh my god, don't ask me these questions. I'm old. Like 3, PS2?
You guys are younger than me. It's probably, I'm like remembering like any, I'm remembering like SNES and NES, like Sega Genesis.
Oh yeah, I started on those. Yeah. We you both turned 30. Yeah, we both turned 37 this year.
Okay, so you're not that much younger than me, but I'm 40.
I mean, 40's just over the hill.
Yeah. Yeah, you're old as shit. Sorry, man.
My body is broken. I actually got an MRI. This is a total off topic. I got an MRI recently. Yeah, they said your spine looks like that of an 80-year-old.
Oh, good.
wear and tear from grappling.
My instructor went to Germany last year for a competition, and he came back and he was like, he couldn't tell if his ankle's broken or not because he got caught in a heel hook.
Ooh.
I would be worried about his knee, especially knee, for a heel hook. Yeah.
He and the other guy both had each other in like a heel hook, and basically his ankle gave out first. But anyway, he was like, I'm not going to get an x-ray because it might tell me it's broken and then I'll have to stop training. I was like, I don't think that logic works.
Perfect logic.
Tied it up and he kept going. And this is why jiu-jitsu people have broken bodies.
Yeah, basically like when I get together and train now, we're all just complaining about like our backs and our elbows and you know, like hobbling around. It's fun though.
Yeah. I know this is, again, really off topic, but do you find that there are people your age still doing, like, because I go to jiu-jitsu, right, and a lot of those guys are literally young enough to be my sons, like, just about. I'm one of the older people there, other than my instructor, who's obviously ancient.
That's not, you know what, a lot of my training partners are, like, in their 50s, and even, I have some, they're, like, my heroes. I, like, tell them, they're, like, in their 60s. Great. Anthony Bourdain didn't start until he was 57.
Okay.
I was lucky enough to write a piece in Rolling Stone about him. He was like had an anonymous account on Reddit where he was posting about jiu-jitsu. He was like so obsessed about it. But he didn't start until he was 57. If you ever go on that, you can still find his username on Reddit. And it's like trademark Bourdain writing. And all he posts about is like how his rib cage feels like a box of Triscuits, like getting crunched because he's like so broken. But he can't stop it because he's addicted.
It is so fun. Yeah.
I think I love it enough that something I picked up for like self-defense classes has become a hobby, a very serious hobby, even though I'm not very good at it. And I do think that there's a lot of value as a writer in having a hobby that has fucking nothing to do with publishing. It really clears your head.
Yeah.
It's very immediate and grounded and real. But definitely, for me, the size is an issue. And like, I was complaining to Scott about this a couple of weeks ago. There's like this dude that I often get paired with, or feel like I often get paired with him. Like he's a really nice guy, right? But he weighs 110 kg, which is 240 pounds. So he's got 110 pounds on me. He's a boxer who also does jiu-jitsu. That's not a fun fight. It's a shit fight, and I hate it.
Yeah, and your chance of injury increases when you're rolling against larger dudes. But you know what, Sonya, if you're smaller, you get better faster. Like that's a problem with bigger guys is they have most of them, unless they're like kind of freak athletes, they have a very hard time getting better at technique because they can't turn off the strength. So
they learn. They lean too much on it.
To be fair, that does see them through a lot.
Yeah. But then you run into like this, you know, every once in a while, there's like a person that's both extremely strong as well as very good at learning. And you're like, you need to be stopped. You're a monster.
So quickly back to books. I'm sorry, I
diverted the podcast to a jiu-jitsu podcast. I'm sorry. It was my ulterior motive.
I actually love jiu-jitsu as well, and I haven't done it for a very long time, but I loved the years that I did do it. But I did want to ask, so you mentioned that you have book 3 of your trilogy coming out in December of this year, which congrats, that's huge to have, you know, an entire trilogy out. What then, right? So you've experienced indie, you've experienced trad, you've now got connections presumably in both, you are a marketing expert in your own right. What are you writing next and what will you do with it? Like, what are your plans?
So right, as of right now, I'm sticking with trad. That is the optimal experience, so to speak, for me because of having three little kids and and trying to keep a business afloat and just wanting to be, again, the ultimate goal for me really is just to write. I know it's like, seems like a far-fetched dream that Sun Ye is living. No. And, but like, I still will
it shouldn't
strive
be.
For that because I know how much I like writing. Like,
yeah,
I think I have the same argument against AI. It's like, why I like writing. Why would I stop writing? This is exactly what I like to do. I don't care what anything else can do. But that's the goal. Not to say that I think it's really good to be able to have an ability to say, you know what? I spent all this time on a manuscript, and if it goes out the sub and doesn't get picked up, then I could if I wanted to pull the trigger on not putting it. I know, like, sometimes you have manuscripts in the back and you could like eventually sell them, but like if I wanted to, and then if something does well, then we know that Trad is not adverse now to picking up self-pub. So it's kind of like in my opinion, you know, where I am right now in the hybrid world, it's like kind of a no-brainer. But again, I would much rather go the Trad route so the next one, I'm almost on sub, like right on the precipice. My agent submitted almost complete manuscript to my editor, because you need to submit to, well, I don't know if it's built into every contract, but typically as far as the contract works on our end,
you're right of first refusal. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So my editor Bradley will hopefully be looking in that. I'm excited. It's kind of like a divergence from, it's still sci-fi, but it's more in like, I would say a broader audience, techno thriller, like kind of akin to Michael Crichton, Blake Crouch. Mm. Michael Crichton's always been one of my favorite authors, and it's kind of like an homage to. So I'm excited for that one to go out. And then, you know, hopefully whether or not Orbit picks it up, I'm not sure. And if they don't, then we have an opportunity to go wide, so to speak, and try to sell it elsewhere.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome.
It's a new, because I've never, that's like a new realm for me. So I really haven't been on, even though my first book went from self-pub to trad, I haven't been on traditional sub, so to speak, before.
So if I can ask very quickly about your debut year, again, just tell me, like, if I'm asking things and you don't want to discuss them, but I seem to remember you organized for basically a book tour and a publicity team. And kind of forked out for that. And I know that Scott didn't have the greatest experience hiring outside publicity, but I wondered how yours went for you. And
No, that's a great question. And I'm glad to talk about it. So this is specifically on the UK side. When Orbit US also buys UK, you get an editor on both the US and UK side. But the UK team is even smaller than the US team. And so one thing I really wanted to do was be able to push the book out in the UK. And so I outsourced to a company called Black Crow. There's a lot of companies out there, I'm not sure who you worked with, Scott, that will do PR for books in general. But I really feel like, given how cloistered the SFF community is and like how voracious the readers are just of SFF, for the most part, I mean, obviously there's branches now with like Romantasy, but I think that is kind of a really important part of it, is having someone that's like the owner of it, Jamie, but like came from the like working PR for one of the major firms like Tor. I'm not sure which one it was, like Tor or Galanz. How do you say? Am I saying it wrong? Galanz. I think that is really important, because end of the day, what is PR? PR is about contact. So if you get like a generic PR firm, they're going to send it out to generic outlets that they have contacts with. If you get a firm that is very specific to the world that we right now write in, then they will have the contacts. And so Black Crow in specific is actually outsourced by some of the big five.
Bunch of them.
For existing authors. So as far as like, now let's talk about whether that was successful or not. And I think it's more akin to like, whether book tour, like what book tours really do, because most of what I was outsourcing for was doing a book tour in the UK, which I see as very, very successful, but not as far as selling books. I don't think book tours, if you're a mid-list author, I don't think they sell books. There's no way around it. I think if you're a big name and you have people, you know, lining up to see you, then certainly. But even that, it's like they're getting books signed, or if they already knew about you, or would they have bought your book anyways?
Yeah.
But so as far as selling books, I don't think my book tour, or really any book tour, you know, for a debut author, would be successful, but I do see it as a success for a few reasons. Primarily, it's like I saw it as I knew what I was getting into, and so I wanted to both meet. I never met my agent before, Ed, who's out of the UK, who's fantastic. I'd never met any of the UK publishing team, and so the previous March, I'd gone to meet the publishing team in New York, and I saw that as a really valuable experience, just getting face-to-face time, getting to see the place. I kind of personally like meeting people face-to-face. Just, I feel like everything now is so removed. And so being able to go to the UK, go to London, not only meet a bunch of authors, like I met a bunch of authors that I had met through Spiffbo. So I knew going into it, my expectations were that I'm going to kind of use this as a personal, for my own reasons, celebration to an extent. I got to, you know, Black Crow did a great job setting up. I got to do an event with Adrian Tchaikovsky at like Waterstones. I did like another event through Comic-Con, which is, again, it's not selling any books. You're going to Comic-Con, which is like, even the authors in Comic-Con are seen as like peasants. They get put in like, there's like the celebrity room and then there's like the author room. And like, apparently someone told me a story, the authors like tried to get into the celebrity room at one point. And many years ago, and so they had to like separate them into another place.
Who let them in here?
Again, it was, for me, that was more of a fun experience. If you're going into a book tour or setting up a book tour and thinking it's going to really sell books, I think that's not the reason to be doing it.
Yeah.
But like from a networking perspective, I hate using the word networking, but like I'd rather just say like person meeting, friend meeting, like networking just sounds very robotic. Just from my own personal perspective of getting to meet my agent, getting to meet the UK team who is lovely, getting to meet all these authors who I'd only, you know, talked with in the past out of the UK, that was, you know, worth it for me.
Yeah. I've
Alex Cochran, is that right? Is that
you said Ed.
Ed Wilson, Ed Johnson.
Wilson, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. He like brought me on a tour of London. He like showed me all like the old pubs and stuff. There's this actor who I know who's in the show Warrior, who we'd like corresponded online. He like also brought me around London. So it was like, wow. It was kind of awesome.
That's awesome.
Did you find that there's like, this sounds wrong, like that it was helpful to meet booksellers? Because I think like I've been talking a lot to Waterstones lately, organizing events with them and stuff, like the ISA and Exchange at Morth. And I feel like in addition to just, I really enjoy it, I do think that there's like some value in booksellers knowing your face, I guess.
Yeah.
Since they're the ones who sell your books.
For me, meeting booksellers, like all the booksellers I've met have been awesome, like face to face. And in the UK, especially, like just being able to talk to them, I don't know if it was helpful, but it was a positive experience for me. Mm. It was really helpful, I think, in the long term, like getting to meet, like I did this, there was called the Fantasy in the Court that they have outside at Goldsboro. Yes. Yeah. Were you there? No, we didn't meet Sunny, did we? No.
No, but it's run, but Goldsboro is run by my agency. It's owned by my agency.
So you're going to be there this year, probably.
No, I'm not on the list. I could go down and just show up unofficially, but it's a long way to go. I have, however, ripped off their format for Fantasy in the Court to create a similar event up north.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It's like everyone's like drinking outside a bookstore. Like, what more could you want? Like a bunch of authors. But I have also got to meet like all the different publishers, which is pretty cool. And so like whether or not they remember like me, some random American guy with a, they probably thought I was just like a straggler off the street. But down the line, you never know. Selling when my agent is selling books, like being able to put a face or a voice or a name to someone, I think it's, there's so many people trying to go after the same thing. I think it could be helpful.
Yep.
It's fun. Like when they drink too much, they tell you way more than they should about their industry.
I love it.
I will say with regard to Black Crow, I've seen them doing excellent work and it seems like they do real things that, you know, whether they provide real results or not, it's not necessarily guaranteed ever, but they are one that I would voluntarily work with. And I think the big issue and what I ran into with PR is trying to substitute your efforts for what your publisher is doing versus add to and work with. And I mean, there's just no amount of PR you can pay for if your publisher isn't playing ball too. So
I mean, we've talked about it before, but it's yeah. not only that if they're not doing it, you're having to make up their shortfall, but in a way that they almost act as a dampener.
I mean, if you don't have books to send somebody, like, what the fuck are you
right.
going to do with the
right.
list?
Have to, yeah. You have to have that initial. Right. No, I fully understand that. Like, if we didn't have physical arcs, I don't, like, I think it's far different sending, no matter what people tell you, I think sending out ebooks might, you know, go so far, but like most of the big book, and like, it's, again, to go back to what I thought really worked, being able to see various booktubers or book talkers hold up a physical arc of the combat codes and show
it matters,
off.
Yeah.
Like, they don't know what to do otherwise. Some people might, you know, Instagram a picture of the Kindle, but it's almost, that's what it's all about. They get a lot of these books on a regular basis, and being able to showcase them, it's a big deal. I mean, back to that, like, what people sometimes don't realize about, like, BookTube, YouTube, as well as, like, BookTok, to some extent, TikTok, is, like, there's an algorithm that goes into YouTube, at least, where if you get ranked, like, let's say a blogger or a YouTuber puts out a video about your book that's, like, my top 10 action sci-fi books, and your book is listed as one. Down the line, it's not just that initial hit of viewers that they're getting. Like, because when they put their video out, there's, based on their viewership, there's going to be an initial however many thousand people that watch it off that initial viewership. But down the line, like, those videos are getting indexed by YouTube, much like Google indexes websites. And so when people are searching YouTube or looking for book recs on YouTube, these videos are getting popped up, so you can get sales, long tail sales, on your book, which is, again, why publishers have these relationships with these booktubers, and why there's this entire ecosystem that has obviously become so important, to the point where, like, Barnes and Noble has a shelf of book talk recommendations, or, you know, we've gotten to a point, maybe oversaturation, but right now, in the past 5-6 years, it's been, I think, extremely important.
I think that the kind of people who go to Instagram and BookTok and YouTube and look for books, they are interested in, like, how the book looks, and its physical presence is a factor for them. Plus, also, a lot of the ARCs that I get, they don't even have a cover. So, you know, you can load up on your Kindle if you want, take a picture of it, but it's just like a blank title page. So
yeah,
the same impact. Did you like your trad cover?
I have a special place in my heart for my self-pub cover. Felix Ortiz, who's now, like, doing, I don't know, he's, like, doing all sorts of stuff. I see him all over the place, and I love that cover, and I definitely have a special place in my heart. That being said, like, that cover was very specific for the audience. And so, like, I think maybe people don't all realize that, like, the self-pub audience is very, like, obviously there's crossover between self-pub, and it's getting a little bit more murky between self-pub and trad, but, like, still to this day, like, there are entire genres that are obviously self-pub that do extremely well and are primarily based on, like, Kindle Unlimited. And so, like, the people that read Kindle Unlimited, by and large, are a separate population from the people that buy paperbacks or buy full price books, which makes sense because you're paying essentially a subscribership like you would for Netflix, and therefore you're getting as many books as you want. I don't think... Where was I there? Sorry.
Covers.
Totally. Sorry. Totally got. So I think what Decision Orbit made to put a dragon on the cover was very calculated, and I think was the right decision as far as if my self-pub cover, which was kind of like almost anime character artwork.
That's why
to
I
some
liked
extent.
It.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's why I liked it. I was very targeted towards that self-pub KU audience, which again is a different audience.
Do you know much about Lit RPG? Have you ever looked into that scene at all?
I personally have never written in that, but I have done a bunch of research given how big it is, and like the offshoot, which is called Progression Fantasy. Like, there are some real big hitters in that, like, I'm sure you guys have heard of, like, Will White, who, that's not Lit RPG, that's more considered Progression Fantasy, which is, like, again, they're like cousins, but those books, like, hit the New York Times, I think one of them hit, like, the number one New York Times bestseller list, and those are, again, that's an entire different audience, really. Again, there must be crossover, but that's a very specific audience. I know for a fact that a bunch of the Big Five have talked or thought about going after lit RPG.
Yes.
And what the response they've gotten is like, they essentially have a barrier to entry, even though there's eyeballs and there's dollar signs in that audience, because it's such a large audience. But the problem is a lot of the big authors are making more, not only through Kindle readership, but through advances that audio publishers will pay them. Mm. And so like what I've heard is like the amount that these audio publishers like Podium or Trantor pay is like prohibitively expensive for trad, especially because it would be a new foray and it would be a risk from their perspective.
I was surprised when Orbit took an interest in it, because, well, I think Orbit produces, you know, like it's one of the few publishers that basically still has a functioning mid-list for our genre, but that means that what they pay in advances is relatively limited. But even a bigger publisher like Tor, unless they're handing out seven figures, I don't see any reason why those authors would sign with them, because they're just making so much fucking money doing what they're doing. And it kind of comes around with publishers going, oh, but there's a market for it. And it's like, yeah, but you don't have the bank for that market.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's a risk. It's a risk for them when they're, especially if they're doing well what they're doing. But I actually think that's what the main play is for Orbit Works. I know there's like a lot of opinions on the digital, that new digital imprint from Orbit. But I actually think that's probably one of their primary goals, is to use that to capture that audience, which they otherwise would not have access to. Like, I'm sure Orbit Works is going to be, I don't know about primarily, but some large portion of it will be KU, I'm guessing. And so, again, they're going to have access to, I'm sure there's also, if they were, you know, they're probably trying to aim to bring a lot of those readers over to their more traditional business through that middle ground imprint.
No, that makes sense. It's nice to hear a theory on that. Further questions, Scott? Go for it.
Yes, I do for you, Sunyi. Have you been eating a huge hunk of chocolate this whole time?
Yeah, I've seen that too.
It's leftover from Christmas. It's those, you know, chocolate on a spoons, and you put them in hot milk and they dissolve.
Sure. Well, yeah.
I want some chocolate now.
Yeah.
I've been eating my kids' Easter chocolate, and like they keep very close tabs on it. And so I'll eat it at night. But then they'll like, they must be getting older, because now they'll know. They didn't used to know. They're becoming sentient.
This is the part where I get to ask our guests what the pettiest hill you would die on is. And I mean, if you need examples, in the past, we've had ones like JT saying that basically thinks Kelvin should be the best temperature measurement, or, you know, Mark Stay going off about American imperialism and things like that. And it can be anything you want.
What's the most controversial thing I can think of to make this podcast get a lot of traction? Let's see. I could do a jiu-jitsu one, but that would be like, who's gonna know what we're talking about? I don't know. Here's something my wife and I always argue about, is like, I will always say cold showers are better than hot showers, hands down. Only cold showers.
Scott's
only
face.
Cold showers. Yeah, look at. there's logic behind it, though. There's logic behind it.
Oh,
and it's
I
not
know
for
it.
Like it's not for some woo-woo health reason. Like, oh, I feel like I'm like prolonging my lifespan. It's just simply because after a hot shower, you feel like tired, and I shower in the morning mainly after working out, after training, and so like after a cold shower, I feel happy. A hot shower.
Yeah.
It feels nice when it's happening, but then you're losing out on the experience after.
That's the real science behind, you know, cold plunges and everything, right? So like, I'm not arguing that. They just suck. For a while, I would do like a normal hot shower, like a normal person who loves himself would do. And then
I am a glutton for pain.
At the end, I would turn it cold, and I'd take like, you know, like 60 to 90 seconds of a cold shower right at the end. Yeah. And that sucks. Yeah,
that's a good start. That's a good start. But like now, if I take a hot shower, I just feel like I'm missing out on.
I mean, look, man,
summer, I will swim in very cold water, but in winter, I'm just cold all the fucking time. I just want to be warm for 5 minutes of the day.
Yeah. I spent So I lived in Brazil for 2 years, and in Brazil, they don't have water heaters. They have things that are called chuveiros. And chuveiros are shower heads that are connected to electricity by the shittiest little wire nuts you've ever seen in your life. Every once in a while, and by every once in a while, I mean like once every few weeks, they explode while you're in the shower often. And so, yes, that is a significant electrocution hazard. But for people with no money stuck in the, luckily we weren't literally in the favelas, but right next to the favelas, it meant cold showers for most of 2 years. So I am no stranger to cold showers. And in São Paulo, the water does get quite cold, especially in their winter. So it's not like there's no relationship there with cold showers. It's just that the relationship is very, very negative.
I think having a choice, having a choice, ma having a choice matters, right? Like if you're consciously turning the water cold, it's different than if you have no choice for a cold shower. I understand. I got you. I got you.
Anyway, so like I've taken a cold shower before, and like when my water heater has gone out in the past in America, I've had to take cold showers, but I would not, and I will not ever take a full cold shower ever again.
I don't know if this is like a, I'll say a jujitsu one. This is more of like a gripe than like a hill I'll die on, but like the gripe is just people not understanding strangles. And I think you guys having done it is just important, but like not understanding people. Most people think that you're getting strangled, and then when you let go of someone after 10 seconds, like in a James Bond movie, that the person's dead. Right. And they won't ever, but in fact, that person is oftentimes waking up within the next 3 seconds and having some like hallucinatory experience.
Unless you hold it too long and you're actually good at it.
And that's where the danger lies, in not knowing.
How long would you have to hold, like, say, a rear naked or whatever that's targeting all of the supply to the brain? How long would you have to hold that for it to be dangerous?
Dangerous. A little bit
Well,
too long. Like a dangerous is like right past the point where the person is unconscious. And even I mean, to be honest, like if you have like respiratory or heart issues, like it's dangerous being
It's always,
unconscious. Of
well,
course, you're
sure,
putting yourself at risk, but like as far as like if you were running some sort of a sick experiment on how long the average person would survive, I would say like a minute and a half, like would probably be too little blood to the brain for it to be able to turn back on. I don't know about the studies, but I'm sure there's a bunch of dangers, at any
Oh,
point
sure.
if you have issues. But most people that have done jujitsu have been choked unconscious at least a few times.
Oh, I'm
Um,
sure
and you
a
see
lot
people,
of times, yeah.
right? I mean, generally you learn, when you're going to go out and are as preemptive as possible again, because you don't want that to be happening to a lot. And apparently if it happens, you're more likely to go out faster. It's almost like having, like once you get knocked out, your chin, you have a chin that is more fragile essentially. I don't know the science behind that or if it's just pseudoscience, but just through hearsay, that's what you hear.
That's interesting. Huh. Now, I think that's all the questions I have for on the podcast, but I have one more that doesn't necessarily need to go on.
Okay. Do you want to plug yourself really quickly then, and Scott can ask a secret question off air?
Oh, great, great, Scott. Now they're going to be asking what was the question off the
That's their problem.
Combat Codes is out now, and Grievous Blood, the sequel, is out now. If you are into science fantasy with action, found family, a lone wolf and cub kind of central relationship, like Arya and the Hound, or what are some others? Mando and Grogu, that sort of central relationship. If you're in, you don't need to be into martial arts. You don't need to understand martial arts. I've been in the world of the combat codes for so long that, to be honest, I'm super excited for my next book, which should be on sub soon, which is again like a Jurassic Park techno thriller a la Blake Crouch.
Yeah, put me on your list for that one.
All right, will do.
And I will say, so I haven't read Combat Codes yet. I've got it on one of my TBR piles, but a close friend has read it and loved it. Said it was legitimately good.
I like the bunny ears there.
No, that was me doing literal quotations.
Okay,
That
I've read it, so there you go.
you read it? Okay, well,
Thank you. I
another.
appreciate. Nope.
You've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.